I invite you to open up to the book of Romans, chapter 6, and we'll begin there in just a moment. Romans, chapter 6. It's good to see such a wonderful number of people out this evening, and visitors I know aplenty, and good to see Chuck and Debbie Bartlett here, and known them for a long time, and he's been giving me a hard time for a long time, and been giving him a hard time for a long time. But it's good to be with brethren and to study God's Word together. And I hope to study a subject that I think is very important for us to get clarity on. The idea of grace, and grace as contrasted with law, I think is among the most misunderstood concepts in religious literature. That the way grace is presented so very often, obviously, there is, there's a way to look at law and a way to look at grace that do come at odds. So, for instance, in Romans chapter 6 and in verse 14, and Paul has a lot to say about some distinctions between faith and works and grace and law. He says in Romans chapter 6 and verse 14, "For sin shall not master over you, for you are not under law but under grace." And so there's some way in which law and grace conflict. But it can't be that the law God gives conflicts with the grace God gives. Right? The conflict is on our end. It's not him saying, here, do this law, but now don't do it in a way that, you know, he's given both of them. Right? They both emanate from him. And so as Paul is going through the book of Romans, really what he's teaching against, I believe, is a misconception of the law and therefore a misconception of grace. And so he is contrasting one misconception against another, or a rightly ordered conception against a misconception. I want to start by asking this. What do grace and law have to say about a command? When God says to do something, when God gives us an instruction in His Word, how do we process that command in terms of grace and in terms of law? I think most people would say that if you have a law mentality, if you're under law, you know, as people would define it in Romans 6:14, for instance, then you would say you have to do the command. And that's pretty much it, right? Law says you have to do it. Then grace says something like you ought to do it. But if you don't, it's okay. Right? So grace, law says you have to do it. Grace says you should, but you don't have to. Or maybe it's you should, but if you don't, then there's forgiveness. And that's the grace, right? I really believe that's a misconception of grace. I believe grace can and does make demands. Sometimes people think grace can't make demands, right? Grace is the free gift. The word grace does not mean free. It means favor. And that favor can come with caveats and conditions, or it can be unconditional, right? It runs the gamut. And I could go to a lot of passages. We don't have time to look at all of those, but if you'd like more information on that, please get with me and I'll tell you more about that. But let me just give you an example of a grace relationship making demands. In John chapter 14, John chapter 14, and there in verse 15, there's two passages here in the two chapters, John chapter 14 and John chapter 15 I want to look at here. John chapter 14 and verse 15, Jesus says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." Then in chapter 15 and verse 14, he says, "You are my friends if you do what I command you." Now, I don't know about you, but if somebody came up to me and says, "Listen, we can be friends so long as you just do whatever I tell you to do," you might go, "Well, I think I'll find some other friends." Right? That doesn't sound like a healthy relationship when somebody says, "Our friendship is going to be rooted in you doing whatever I tell you to do." But in reality, We actually do have some relationships like that all along the way. I know that when I was working with my dad or my granddad when I was a little boy, they would say something pretty similar to this. You just do everything I tell you to do, and we're going to get along great. I had some coaches who talked like that. They'd say, listen, just do what I'm telling you to do, and we'll be friends. And let me just tell you, I don't begrudge those men. In fact, they're some of the most beloved men in my life who demanded that of me. And our relationship really was better. And it's because they actually did know better, right? Between us, they're the ones that needed to be listened to, not me, right? If they were listening to me, it would have been a wreck. And so it was true that the relationship was better for me listening to them. And so it really was grace that they demanded that I listen to them. It was for my good and my benefit that they were telling me to listen to them. And I would say that even in the context of peers, where it might be a little bit more unhealthy if a peer came up to you and said, you know, we can be friends if you just listen to me. I would say that even in the relationship of peers, if somebody says, I want to be your friend, but I will pay attention to nothing that you want or desire or need. Well, it'd be pretty hard to be friends with somebody like that, right? That you do really do, you have to pay attention to the other person in order to have a relationship. Jesus, though, is taking that to the standpoint of who needs to be listened to in our relationship. Well, it's him every time. Grace also, I would suggest, when we're talking about a command that God gives, it demands more from us, not less from us. In Matthew chapter 5 there, after the Beatitudes, you know that Jesus begins to go into a series of instructions where he says, you have heard that it was said, or in the LSB, you have heard that the ancients were told, but I say unto you. So in one of those, he says, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not murder. And then he goes on, whoever murders shall be guilty before the court. But I say to you, that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Sanhedrin. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you're presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember your brother something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Make friends, he says, quickly with your opponent at law. So, as you're looking at this instruction, Jesus quotes, as he does throughout this series, something that Moses has said. Now, I believe when he quotes what Moses has said, he quotes it in the context of the interpretation that the Pharisees had made of it. And you get a little picture of that here, because what he's saying is, you've heard that it was said, don't commit murder, and if you commit murder, you're really going to be in trouble, right? You're going to be guilty before the court. And Jesus goes on to show that what he demands is more than just not murdering, right? The command to not murder actually doesn't stop at don't murder. Now, this shouldn't be a big shock to us. You know, you might think, well, if God wanted more than that, he should have said as much. I don't know about you, but when I got to a certain age, when me and my siblings, I have three siblings, and when we got to a certain age, we got to that point where Mom, you know, would go grocery shopping, and I assume now that I'm a parent that what she was looking for was just time separated to decompress from these four children. And she might say something. She would say something like, listen, just don't murder anyone while I'm gone. Just try not to kill each other, right? So then she'd leave. And then she comes back, and can you imagine the comfort she would feel if she's pulling back in, and I run out to the driveway and say, listen. First of all, we did what you said. Nobody's dead. She's going to go, oh, well, good. I'm not suspicious at all. It doesn't sound like anything bad's happened. Right? It sounds like you did exactly what I wanted. No, of course, if she says that, she's not saying that's the only thing I want. Right, her expectations are a little bit higher than stop short of murdering each other. This is like if you were counseling someone and they said, like genuinely, I'm thinking about murdering someone. And you said, well, the first thing we need to do is talk you down off that ledge, right? We need to get you. And imagine if here, Brad and Steve, you heard about a situation like that, and then Josh comes and he says, it's okay, he's decided he's not going to murder anyone. You wouldn't be like, well, all right, good. No problem then. No, you'd be like, well, I think we need to have some more conversation. Like, I mean, I'm super glad he's not murdering anybody. But what in the world was going on? Right? What led to this? What made him think this? What you have with the Pharisees is they're looking and they're saying, as long as you don't murder, as long as you don't commit adultery, as long as you don't do the very specific thing that God said not to do, you're golden. And Jesus says, nonsense. You should know more than that. In Romans chapter 13, that's what Paul says. He says that these commands in the Ten Commandments are summed up in the one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, you don't love your neighbor simply by not murdering him. But I will say this, you do start there. Right? It's a good place to start. But God means for you to go beyond that and get to the place of actual affirmative love for your neighbor. I think that's what's seen in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 8. 1 Timothy 1 and verse 8, it says, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, knowing this, that law is not made for a righteous person, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and the sinners, for the unholy and godless, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for sexually immoral persons, for homosexuals, for kidnappers, for liars, for perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. I think Paul is talking about the law in sort of its surface function. Most people should not have to be told not to murder someone. Right? Most people don't need, but some people do. I would say read Leviticus chapter 18. Most of Leviticus chapter 18, you read through it and say, I didn't need anybody to tell me not to do that. But somebody does. And the idea is that God is not satisfied with you just stopping short of what's in Leviticus chapter 18. He's not satisfied with you stopping short of murder. Now, yes, if somebody's thinking about that, this is the command that's like the final straw. But the ideal, as you look through the whole of God's law, is love for neighbors, love for God. You know, when God says you shall have no other gods before me, he really sums that up with love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul and strength and mind. Right? That is the negative commands that start the Ten Commandments are summed up with the affirmative command that you ought to love God. And then the second half is summed up with you ought to love your neighbor. I also would say that grace makes the demands in the context of grace. What do I mean by that? That God never makes a demand of you that is not for your benefit. He never asks anything of you that is not going to be for our eternal best interest. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 30, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I am trying to make your life better, God tells us. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 24, Deuteronomy 6 and verse 24, this is not just a New Testament concept. It says, Yahweh commanded us to do all these statutes, Moses tells the people, to fear Yahweh our God for our good all our days and for our survival as it is this day or as it is today. He's doing this for our good. How many times have you had that conversation as a parent? Sometimes your kids get to a point and they assume that your life's joy is in making their life miserable, right? I assume, you know, your children look at you, your teenagers might especially look at you and say, you just like me to be miserable, don't you? And of course, that's not the case. Like, it's the literal opposite of this. Misery is the thing I'm trying to keep you from. And you might see them going, I'll do it. I'll do it because you said so, because you're the parents, because I got no other choice. But they don't think, they're not thinking in terms of truly you have their best interest at heart. And you know the whole time you do. And it's so painful. It's painful to watch. And it's painful to, for God to watch us look at His commandments like He's trying to keep us from things that would bring us so much joy. That is at the heart of the very first sin. Is it not? That Satan comes in and he tries to convince Eve, God is trying to keep you from something that would be so good for you. And she buys it. And she does what God had commanded her not to do and destroys everything. I think that what we need is to not only receive God's grace, but I think that grace is a reciprocal relationship. And what God requires of us is to come to His law with favor. Favor for Him, favor for His rules, that we love these laws and we want to see what God is telling us through His laws. And we are not just looking at the surface and making sure we've just got the very bare minimum covered, but we're saying, what is it that He wants me to learn? We're going to talk more about that tomorrow night as we talk about as He is holy and see what is God teaching us through His law. But let me give you an example. Look over at Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13. So when it comes to the Sabbath day, the Pharisees looked at the Sabbath day and they basically saw one thing: do not work. That's what they saw. And they went about trying to make up rules to make sure that they followed that command: do not work. And so they stretched that out and they said, well, this is work, and this thing is work, and that thing is work. And they expanded way beyond what God ever intended. But it was all in service of following the command, do not work. Well, certainly that is a command of the Sabbath, right? So I don't want to minimize the fact that that's a reality. But in doing that, in seeing just the command, do not work, they didn't bother to ask the question, why? Like, what's the purpose? What does that point to? There are two foundations given for the Sabbath. The first one is in Exodus chapter 20, when the Ten Commandments are given. When you get down to the Sabbath, is remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, for the Lord your God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day He rested. So the one foundation for the Sabbath is God's rest on the seventh day. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, there's a repetition of the Ten Commandments. God goes all the way back through them. And there's only one change, and that is in the commandment of the Sabbath. Instead of saying 6 days He created, on the seventh He rested, it says, because you were in bondage in Egypt and God brought you out. He gave you rest from your bondage, right? So God rested, that's foundation number one. God gave you rest, that's foundation number two, from your bondage. All right, Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13. You remember so many of the occasions where Jesus does something on the Sabbath and He gets called for it. Here's another one of those occasions. It says He was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who for 18 years had a sickness caused by a spirit. She was bent double and could not straighten up at all. And when Jesus saw her, He called her over and said to her, woman, you are freed from your sickness. Notice He did not say you are healed. He said you are freed. And He laid His hands on her, and immediately she was made erect again and began glorifying God. But the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus healed on the Sabbath, answered and was saying to the crowd, there are 6 days in which work should be done, so come during them and get healed, and not on the Sabbath day. But the Lord answered and said, you hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath release his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it? And this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound for behold, 18 years, should she not have been released from this bond or this bondage on the Sabbath day? Can I suggest to you that what Jesus is saying is that I have not violated the Sabbath day, I have fulfilled the Sabbath day. I have released this woman from bondage on the very day that is supposed to remind you about your release from bondage. They don't get that. All they get is, looks like work to me. Well, not all work's the same, is it? And so, what God wanted them to see in the Sabbath, Jesus has fulfilled in the Sabbath, but because of the way they looked at the law, they condemned Jesus for fulfilling the very law they claimed to uphold. That's how twisted you can get when you are saying, I'm just trying to do what God says. Well, what you end up doing is misunderstanding the very law that you claim to uphold. I want to talk about cultivating grace then. Cultivating grace toward God, toward His law, so that we can better understand what it is that He is telling us. Go back, if you will, with me to Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22. And there with the story of Balaam. It's a story that I think most of us would be familiar with, especially the part where Balaam's donkey speaks to him. A lot of times, as we're going through the story of Balaam, it's easy for us to see a picture of a man who repeatedly seems to have the right attitude. And he wants to just do exactly what God says, and somewhere along the way, he just kind of gets off track and he finally disobeys God. So, for instance, Numbers chapter 22 and verse 38, it says, so Balaam said to Balak, behold, I have come now to you. Am I able to speak anything at all? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak. Man, you could just make that a pretty good verse for a gospel meeting, couldn't you? Like that works really well. All I can do is just say what God says. It sounds like Balaam's on the right track. I want to be like Balaam. You don't want to be like Balaam. In fact, so much do you not want to be like Balaam that he becomes a prototypical example of rebellion in the New Testament. He is brought up three times in the New Testament to say Balaam represents rebellion against God, and particularly rebellion against God for sordid gain. Well, let's look at the story then. If you recall, backing up to the beginning of the chapter, you've got Israel set out, camped in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan, opposite Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous. And Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian, now this assembly will lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass from the field. And so Balak, verse 5, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of the people, to call him, saying, behold, a people come out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they settle opposite me. So now, please, come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to strike them down and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian went away with the fees for divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke Balak's words to him. And he said to them, spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as Yahweh may speak to me. And the leaders of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God said to Balaam, God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? Let's stop right there. Now, you might think nothing's happened so far, right? Nothing's been violated. No, he's just asking questions. Well, there's just asking questions, and then there's just asking questions. There have been multiple occasions in my life where people have said, what did your parents say when you asked them if you could, you know, do this? And I say, I don't know. I never asked my parents that sort of question. Because I would have gotten in trouble for asking the question because that would have indicated I didn't know the answer. Right? I can remember my parents or my friends saying, what did your parents say when you asked them if you could go to the prom? And I was like, That's not a conversation we're going to have. I know what the answer is. And I know the answer will be even worse if I ask the question. I just don't ask the question. I remember one time we had a choir concert that they scheduled on a Wednesday night. And I went to my choir director and I said, listen, I'm not going to be able to make it to this choir concert. And he said, well, have you asked your parents? And I said, nope, have not. And he said, well, could I call them and ask them? And I said, listen, you can do whatever you want to, but you make sure you tell them Stephen said he could not come, because I don't want them to think I didn't know what the answer was. I think when Balaam comes to God and he wants to know, can I go with these men? And God asks the question, who are these men with you? First of all, let me just say, God is never asking a question like that because he doesn't know the answer. Like when he asks Adam, where are you? It's not like, I have no idea, I've looked everywhere. He's not going, who are these men? I've never met them. No, I think what he wants is for Balaam to say out loud, oh, these are the men who've come to hire me to curse your blessed people. And if you say it out loud, you hear how dumb that is, right? You don't have to go any further. But I'm going to tell you what, Balaam's problem is he plays dumb the whole time. He says, who are they? Oh, this is who they are. Already, Balaam is in trouble and either doesn't know it or refuses to know it. So, God does ask the question. Balaam gives the answer as if he doesn't know it's a problem. God said to Balaam in verse 12, do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. God has made a promise. Whoever blesses these people will be blessed. Whoever curses these people will be cursed. That is an ancient promise by this point. So, we go on, and of course they go back to Balak, and then Balak says, go back again. And the people come back again. They came to Balaam and said, verse 16, thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing, I beg you, withhold you from coming to me. I will indeed honor you richly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Please come and curse this people for me. And Balaam replied to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, to trespass the command of Yahweh God. So please, now, you also stay here tonight, and I will know what else Yahweh will speak to me. Well, here's point two. If I didn't know the answer before, and mom or dad said no, it didn't get better by asking again. You don't go back to God when his will has been clearly revealed. You don't restudy the issue to try to find different revelation than what's already been recorded. But that's what Balaam's doing. Maybe I could get a different answer. So he goes back, and he asks again. And it says, that God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you shall you do. So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab. But God was angry because he was going. Now at this point, people get real confused. Because it says God told him to go. And then it says God's angry because he was going. So what's going on here? And now the angel of the Lord is taking a stand in the way and is about to kill him. Can I suggest to you that God has already given Balaam the answer he needs? And then he's given Balaam the answer he wants. This happens a lot in relationships. Imagine some of you young men, you've been married a few years, but not many. And you come home one weekend and you say, listen, the guys have planned a big hunting trip for this particular weekend. And she looks at you and says, that's our anniversary. And you say, I know. And I told them that, but they said that's the only weekend they can do that. Is that okay? And she says, do whatever you want to do. If what you think she said was, I'd really love you to go, you are a fool. And you cannot blame that on her. A lot of guys would say, well, she said, No, you are the one who ought to have better sense in that moment to understand what's being communicated. Balaam has been told, don't go. And he says, well, God, they're back. What should I do? And God says, if you want to go, go. And then Balaam says, okay, God said I could go. And God says, I cannot believe him. That is not God being hard to understand. That is Balaam being obtuse and refusing to acknowledge what has already been made clear. Let me show you how far this obtuseness goes. You recall the angel is standing in the way, the donkey moves out of the way, the donkey runs him against the wall, and then finally the donkey lays down and won't move, and Balaam begins to beat him, and the donkey's mouth is opened, and he speaks to Balaam. And at that moment, you recall, the eyes of Balaam are opened, and what he is able to see is the angel of the Lord standing there. In verse 32, it says, the angel of Yahweh said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out as an adversary, because your way was contrary to me. And the donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If it had not turned aside from me, I would surely have killed you just now and let it live. And Balaam said to the angel of Yahweh, I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. All right, so far, so good. Then he says, so now, if it is evil in your sight, I will turn back. It sounds like the guy with the sword about to cut your head off thinks it's evil. And Balaam's going, listen, if you really want me to not go, I'll turn back. Have you ever had a moment like this? Especially, I know as a teenager I did this to my parents. I rue the day. I would say, Mom, if you really want me to do this, and she goes, what I want is for you to want to do it. And I'm thinking, well, I don't, but I'll do it if you say you want me to do it. And she's saying, no, that's not what I want. I want you to want to do the thing I'm asking you to do, but I'm not going to force you to do it. And I'm going, look, you say the word and I'll do it. She doesn't say the word because she wouldn't force me to do it. She wanted me to love her enough to do the thing she was asking to do. And I walked away. I'll tell you one time that happened that hurts me to this day. It was my grandfather's 65th birthday. My grandfather that I loved dearly. But I didn't love him dearly enough, not at the time. And she said, you need to be there, but I'm not going to make you go. And I said, listen, all you have to say is you have to be there and I will go. And she said, I'm not going to say you've got to come be at your grandfather's birthday. I can't even tell you what I went to do with my friends instead. All I know is that she knew better than I did. And I would give anything for 5 more minutes with my grandfather. Much less to have one more memory to add. Versus a memory that was forgotten in a week. So God tells us, I know what's best for you, and I'm begging you to do the thing. And here I'm showing you that there's judgment, there's destruction this way. And we see all of that and we say, well, listen, just say the word. Just force me. And I won't do that. God says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to force you. I'm begging you, but I won't force you. So Balaam, in all his stupidity, keeps going down that path. And what does he do? He pretends to be so noble because he will only speak what God has said. But in his heart, the whole time, he is who he has always been, which is somebody who wants the money, who wants the pleasure, who wants the fame, and eventually he finds a way to get it. He finds the loophole. And the loophole is, if you will make these people sin, God will curse them. And he's right. He finds that loophole and they are cursed because they sin. And then so is Balaam. Because people who curse God's people end up being cursed. But Balaam could have avoided all of this when the people showed up by saying to them, without ever having to go to God, you want me to curse who? I don't think so. I want no part of it. I don't even have to ask God this. I know what God says about this. And that is the way that we come to God with the grace that wants to interpret God's words in ways that show that we love God and we know that He has our best interest at heart. I want to just give a case study of this. In Hebrews chapter 10, Hebrews chapter 10 and verses 24 and 25, you know what this verse is, right? This is the verse that says you've got to come to church. It's where we go when somebody says, do I have to be there? What do you say when somebody says, do I have to? I tell you, if I'm at home, I don't have teenagers right now, but I've had two of them, and expect to have more if we make it there. You know, you say, hey, I need you to get up and take out the trash. And then you get the, do I have to? Now, how do you answer that? Well, there's a lot of different ways you can answer that. Right? You could say, no, you don't have to. You don't have to have a bed to sleep in at night. You don't have to have air conditioning or food on the table. You don't have to do anything. That's kind of a sarcastic way. It's true. But it's not really effective. Usually just makes things worse. You could say, just absolutely, no, I'll just do it myself. You could say, yes, you have to do it. And if you don't, here's the consequence. Just get up and take the trash out. But I tell you what, teenagers who are here, I tell you what your parents want to say. I don't want you to even think in those terms. I want you to realize you are a part of this household. And you are a part of what makes this trash. And you ought to want to participate in what keeps this household going. And that this is a very small way that you can do that. That's what your parents want to say. Now, usually you just want to get back to your video game or whatever else it is you are doing. What they want you to do is look and say, Mom, what a small thing it is for you to ask me to do. Absolutely, I will take out the trash. I'm going to tell you, I'm just giving you a little life hack. If you want to cause your mom to pass out, just say that, right? And you will engender so much favor in that moment. But I'm going to tell you what, that doesn't stop when people are teenagers. I don't know how many times I've had people say, do I have to be there when it comes to church? And I feel pretty much the same way as my teenager. What do I say to those people? You could do the same thing. No, you don't have to come to church. You don't have to go to heaven. Like, whatever. Or they say, you say, look, you just go the easy route. You say, look, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25 says, not forsaking our assembling, our own assembling together is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. There it is. It says, don't do it. You should be here. Don't forsake it. But in reality, what we need to say is the Hebrew writer is not just wanting you to be there. He is wanting you to realize how vital it is both for you and your brethren to be there. That this is a guard against the devil who is trying to get at your soul. Somebody says, will I go to hell if I'm not there? You won't go to hell for not being here. You'll go to hell for not wanting to be here. For not wanting to be near God and not wanting to be near His people. And so the very question just exposes a heart problem that says, I don't really want to love God. I just want to make sure I don't get in trouble. I want to pause here before I move to two more points and go back to Romans chapter 6, because I think this is the difference. Going back to Romans chapter 6 and in verse 14, when he says, sin shall not be master over you, for you are not under law but under grace. Look at the whole context. He is saying that we want to be free from practicing sin. Paul is not saying sin shall not be master over you because you won't be held accountable for sin anymore. He says sin shall not be master over you because you don't live that life anymore. Right? The life that is a slave to sin. And I believe that what he means is this. That there are two ways of looking at things. There's a law way and a distorted law way of looking at things. And there's a grace way of looking at things. I have a law relationship with the IRS. Sam was dealing with the IRS today, and we were talking about our mutual love for the IRS. Here's what I want to know. I want to know what I have to pay him down to the penny, and I don't want to pay him a penny more. I don't send them love letters. I don't call them on the phone to see how they're doing. I don't try to build relationships with them. In fact, I want to hear from them as little as possible. I want to know the bare minimum just to keep them out of my lives, out of my life. Can I suggest to you that a lot of people treat God that way? I really want them to stay out of my business. Tell me what I need to do, when I need to show up, what kind of money do I need to give, so I can go on about my business. But God will not have that sort of relationship with you. Now, when it comes to my relationship with my wife, I don't ask my wife, how much do I need to spend on our anniversary that's coming up? It's 20th anniversary this year, 25th. That was close. 25th anniversary this year. How much do I need to spend so that I don't get in trouble? I'm going to just tell you what. I'm already in trouble. Right as soon as I say that. It's not good. No, I don't approach it that way. Our relationship is not one where I'm asking for exact calculations about what I'm supposed to do. Precise rules that I'm supposed to live by. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't rules. It just means that our relationship is not defined and cannot be just reduced to that. Now, let me ask you this. On the one hand, which is more demanding of me? Well, my marriage demands a lot more of me than the IRS. In time and effort and concern and even heartache and joy, there's so much that goes into that relationship. And which relationship is easier? Well, I'd say the marriage relationship. I consider the IRS relationship kind of a nightmare. But I love this relationship. And this burden is easy. And this yoke is light. Because it is one of grace. Even though it's way more demanding, there's no comparison. Now, I will say this. One of the key rules in a marriage is do not commit adultery. When people have to be told that rule, the marriage is already in trouble. When you are bumping right up against that rule, it means you're living your relationship by law or in that law mentality. It's not good. Nevertheless, the rule is there. And so there is a law in that relationship. Well, In talking about cultivating grace, as we try to cultivate this grace in discerning what God's Word says, discerning what His will is, look over at Luke chapter 10 and verse 29. Luke chapter 10 and in verse 29. You remember the man who asked the question about the greatest command. The man's asking, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? Jesus says, love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus answers him, you've answered correctly, do this and you will live. Wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Now, this is that sort of question like, do I have to? Jesus could take the easy way out and just give him a frank answer. But as he often does, he comes back with a story, and then he comes back with a question. And the story is interesting because I think sometimes what we think the story means is that everybody's your neighbor. And I really don't think that's Jesus' point in this particular place. In fact, what he asks, the question at the end, it says, Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands? And so he doesn't ask the question. The question that gets asked to Jesus is, who is my neighbor? The question Jesus answers back is, who has been a neighbor? And I think the point to the lawyer is that the one asking the question, he's wondering who I have to be neighborly to. And I think in the end, Jesus says, who have you ever been a neighbor to? And that really turns it on its head. Right? And it makes you think a lot deeper. Sometimes people ask questions. Our children ask questions. And the easy way out is just to give them a pat answer. Right? Just yes or no. I know people in congregations ask that in Bible classes. They ask a question. Is it okay to do this or this? I remember a brother was asked one of those kind of questions. And for 20 minutes, he went on about the wisdom of this idea and the wisdom of this idea and says, you know, depending on circumstances, but here's what God's word says about it. And the guy goes, listen, so yes or no? Like, is it okay? You don't want to please God, do you? You just want to be told like the IRS, yes or no. And you want a law relationship. Just tell me yes or no. You're like Balaam. You really want to do the thing. You won't if God says not to, but you really want to do it. You want to know what God wants of you. This guy who says, who is my neighbor, is trying to get out of responsibility. And instead of Jesus really saying, you ought to just be a neighbor to everybody, Jesus in fact says, I'll tell you what, why don't you pick out one person and be a neighbor to anybody? And that just turns the whole thing upside down. That's what we've got to do sometimes. We've got to not be willing to just give in to the easy path. And we've got to do the hard work, especially with our children, but also in Bible classes and with our brethren, that we walk through and we help people understand that there's more than yes and no to the questions that get asked. And then we also have to understand that when we are teaching, when we are cultivating grace towards God's commands and understanding God's commands and participating with God, that we take everyone's best interest into account. God allows us to participate with Him in a way that He does not need. God has never needed my help. It is interesting to me in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 4, as Paul is making the collection to take to the needy saints in Judea, he says of those who are in Macedonia that they were begging us with much urging for the grace, see there's that grace word, the grace of sharing in a ministry of the saints. They are begging us to be a part. Now, Paul says, there's not much they can do, but I let them because they just wanted to be a part. And they saw that it was a grace to them that they were allowed to participate. He uses that same language over in Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 17 in his own support. He says, not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek the fruit which increases to your count. I know it'll do you some good. I think that we need to understand when we're trying to cultivate participation and grace with our children, grace towards us and therefore grace towards God, that we have got to cultivate that even at an age where they can't really be of great help to us. In April of 2011, April 27, 2011, a number of tornadoes came through Alabama. Some of you may remember that. It just wreaked havoc. I mean, it was like just a vacuum cleaner went across the state and just tore through. And so we went up. We went to work in my in-laws' community and cutting trees and, you know, trying to help people out best we could. And as we were there doing that, we were working at my great aunt's house and cutting trees away from her house. And an old man looked in his, well, I won't say how old he was, you know, I might offend somebody, but he was old by my perspective. But anyway, he comes around on a four-wheeler, dragging a small trailer with drinks and snacks and things like that behind it. And he comes up and he says, does anybody want a drink or a snack? Well, people had sent us with so much stuff, we just, you know, we had stuff coming out our ears. And we just said, no, we appreciate it. No, thanks. We're good. And so he takes off. Well, he comes back around like 45 minutes later. And it's clear nobody's taking a drink and nobody's taking a bar or anything. And he says, does anybody need something? Candy bar, you know, drink? No, we're good. We're fine. And he puts off again. He comes back about 45 minutes later. And I start to walk over to tell him we're really fine and tell him, you know, we're covered. We got all the snacks we can use. And an older man that was helping us put his hand on my shoulder and said, Stephen, that man is desperate to participate in what's happening here. He can't pick up a salt. He's too old for that. And he is trying in some way to contribute to what's happening in this community. Would you go take a drink from him, please? And I did. And it was pretty clear that that made his day. Not because I needed what he had to offer. He needed to participate. Right? He needed to be a part. And sometimes we don't pay attention to what the person on the other end needs. When our children are very small, you know this, they love to help. When I go out to the garden, the other day I was going out to the garden, and Ronald said, are you headed out to the garden? I was putting my boots on. I am. He said, do you need some help? And I said, I sure could use some help. And he said, I'm your boy. Now, most 16-year-olds don't say that, but 6-year-olds do. And I said, you are my boy. Let's go. Now, can I tell you, garden work is not more efficient with a 6-year-old than without. I don't not only get less done, sometimes I have more to do when we finish than when we started. But I don't take him out to help me because I need his help. I take him out to help me because I need him to understand what participation looks like. Because one day I will look over and I will need him to help me. One day we were chopping wood together and I had to help him, and he said, you always have to help me. I said, I do. But there'll be a day when I'll be the one that is your little helper. And you'll have to be helping me. Which is an idea that he loves. But I want to cultivate that all along the way. I don't want to ignore it, and then one day when he's 13 say, now's the time to obey me. It won't happen. You can't ask that out of the blue, all of a sudden. Or what's worse, we don't cultivate and we push to the side, no, you don't get to participate, and then one day we say, it's time to be baptized. Time to serve God. We haven't been cultivating the attitude in the heart that leads to that. God does that, right? He asks us to help him in all of our feebleness. He cultivates love, and he makes us feel more important than we really are. We read about that yesterday with David in 1 Chronicles when he says to God, you have raised me up. I am nothing. I am nothing. You are everything. And yet, look at all that you've done for me. And so, when we get into wrangles about what this says, sometimes, not every time, but sometimes it's because what we're doing is something like the Pharisees. We're just saying, look, it says don't work. Yeah. Well, what does it mean by that? Or somebody says, listen, I just think that it seems to me that this would be the best way to handle this. This would be the best way to do this. Listen, as I said yesterday, I don't care about that. I care. This is the Lord and King. I want to please Him. I want to know what pleases Him. Not just on the surface, but deep down and throughout, I want to please Him. And so I don't want the arguments to end up as just mere surface arguments. Truly get down to the roots. What does God want from us? What is His church about? We'll be talking about that more as we go along through the week. This is not a standard lesson on authority. But I think it's part of how we establish authority. I think Balaam could have said in a lot of ways that he was acting on authority, but he wasn't. He was acting against it the whole time. And there's a lot of people who might say that, you know, they've pulled a verse or two out of context or just a shallow interpretation. Say, I'm just trying to do what God says. But they're really not. They're just doing what they think's best. What about you? Are you a participant in grace with God? Or are you demanding some kind of a law relationship full of do I have to questions? Grace can ask, what must I do? I think it's a gracious question in Acts 2 and verse 37. What must we do? But it asks as one that's eager for an answer. If you're asking what all do I have to do? That's not what they're asking. What they're asking is, oh no, we have killed the true king. What could we possibly do? And if you are asking that, and if you are coming as a willing servant, asking the master, what next? What can I do? What else could I possibly do for you? Why then, you can come. And you can find a master ready to show you what to do next. Ready to make his will known to his people. And if there's anyone who would respond like they did in Acts 2:38, to repent and be baptized, washing away your sins, receiving the gift of the Holy Spirit, well then won't you come this evening while we stand and while we sing?